Welcome to PPM Simplifies. This is a weekly podcast that will help you have a better understanding on environmental regulations and how they relate to your industry. In each episode, we'll talk with experts across various industries who will share their insights with you. This is PPM Simplifies. We are back on the air, and we are kicking off 2024 with a fantastic podcast. We're going to start a new series, and you'll hear this a few times during the year, called Environmental Consulting Stories. And what better spot to start is let's talk a little bit about due diligence. We think our listening audience will find some of our stories, hopefully all of them, pretty interesting. And there's no one better in the firm than my partner and co-founder, the Big M in PPM, Mr. Mike McCann out of Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Oh, great, Todd. Good to be with you. Thank you for the invitation.
Man, absolutely. And I really think our audience is going to get a good kick out of this because, you know, when you're doing due diligence, you're looking for all kinds of potential environmental concerns or recognized environmental concerns, although that's a potential. But when you're out there in the field, sometimes these facilities are have not been in commerce or production, and they're just a lot of conditions you'll see. So is that general topic to kind of launch into it? That's a great place to tell some of our stories, isn't it?
It sure is.
So, Mike, when folks go out and do diligence, you know, let's maybe start off with what type of folks go out to the field to do due diligence, and then maybe we should define due diligence too.
Yeah, a couple of things here. You know, just an overview of the due diligence process. I'm sure a lot in the audience may already know this and all, but just like, you know, every time a piece of commercial property or industrial property changes hands, there's a series of due diligence tasks that are done. You want to make sure the survey boundaries are correct, there's no tax liens on it, it's, you know, the appraised value is correct, and environmental conditions is another one. So the industry has come up with many years ago, it goes back to the 80s, I guess, a phase one environmental site assessment process, and there's standards out there to do these, and basically you're kicking the tires to make sure there's no environmental issues on the property that could come back and haunt you as a buyer, or if you're a lender on the property, that could impact the value of the property. And the phase one process, I mean, it's a deep dive into the previous use of the property. You do that by looking at historical records, environmental records, interviews with people who know about the facility, used to work there, used to own it, those kinds of things. And of course, a site inspection, we go out and actually kick the tires and look around for anything, you know, odors, stained soils, drums of chemicals, you know, process areas where something used to be done there. And, you know, it goes, there's just lots of different things you can find on those. And then it all gets wrapped up in a report, and to tell you as the potential buyer or taking a collateral interest in the property, if there's any issues or not you should be concerned about, and that may affect your buying decision or your negotiation with the seller. And you'd also ask Todd about the level of experience of people. And, you know, one thing's about these, you know, the fees on these phase ones, they're not real expensive projects. They run typically from, you know, $3,000 to $6,000 range, a lot more if it's a big industrial facility. And because they're low fees and quick turn, a lot of times you get people out there doing these in environment with environmental firms that don't have a lot of experience. They're not high fee projects, so you can't put your most expensive experienced people on the job. But there's a way around that, and that is the standard requires for an environmental professional. There's a specific definition based on qualifications and experience to be involved with the project. They may not be the ones in the field doing it, but they should be deeply involved with the person doing the field work, looking the records, reviewing the report, working with them throughout the project to make sure nothing gets missed. So it's a mixed bag of maybe some of your greener staff and some of your really highly experienced staff that are doing the work. And I can't emphasize how important it is to have experience on the team.
You know, Mike, and that is a great summary of the process. And there's maybe even one other thing to add into this mix as we talk about due diligence and some of the stories that we've encountered through the years, all the clients are different. Each client is unique. Each client has a different threshold of what do they want to know, their curiosity level. Sometimes it's very formal through lending institutions. Sometimes it's individuals with cash. You're not quite sure how far to go. Attorneys enter the mix. So give us a flavor of the different types of, maybe not picking on anyone, but clients and different folks we encounter on the client side of the due diligence process.
Yeah. That's a great topic there, Todd. And I guess let me start with, you're talking about risk tolerance here, the risk tolerance of the client who's actually buying the property or taking collateral interest in it. And one of the most conservative I've seen out there is a project that is financed by HUD, you know, the Housing and Urban Development Department, the federal government. They have very strict standards and basically accept no risk on something being developed as a housing project, or maybe it's even an office building for a HUD property. And they want to see every potential environmental concern mitigated. And then you go all the way up to maybe like a developer. On the very other end of the spectrum would be somebody who is, what they're looking for is location, 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 right? That's what we always hear. And they may not care that much. Well, that's probably saying it incorrectly. They care, but they'll take all kind of risks because they're about to put in some big, you know, commercial property there. It may be an old corner gas station that's got high visibility, and they will accept a high degree of environmental risk on it because what they're after is getting something out there that's producing revenue in a visible area. And so in between those two bookends, you have all different levels. You know, you have lending institutions. Some are very loose about what they require on environmental due diligence. Some are pretty risk intolerant on it. And then you have attorneys, and the attorney is always going to represent what's in the best interest of their own client, whether it's buyer or seller, which is another dynamic. You have the seller involved in the transaction who doesn't want you to find anything, and the buyer who doesn't want to take risk. And so that's where good consulting practice, good legal counsel comes in to find the risk tolerance of those who are really going to be on the line and find a way through it, which is basically, if I can advertise for PPM, that's our sweet spot, is helping our clients mitigate and get through all that, understand the risk, and still have deals happen and commerce go on.
Simplifying the complex.
That's it.
I love it. I love it. And not just because we created that. on that note, you bring out another great point, Mike. As you have a candidate site, a property, a facility that you're looking at, you know, obvious things like if it was built in the 50s or 60s, you might be suspicious of lead paint or asbestos containing materials. If it was a gas station, an underground storage tank, those things are pretty obvious. But the art in doing environmental site assessments, due diligence, it really is in seeing all the potential liabilities and then some liabilities that you might think are risk, but they really aren't once you study it and determine the use of it and how it really impacts the site. But what are some things that can happen out there where, you know, either, you know, maybe we or other firms we looked at their work may have missed? What are some of the trickier things?
Yeah. In some of these, you know, we all learn by life experience, right? And case studies and things that we've seen in the past. So I do want to spend maybe a good bit of time talking about some of the things we've seen out there that appeared to be, you know, we have properties where something looks really good, but it really wasn't. We have other ones where it looked terrible, but really there were no issues out there. So if I can take a minute and talk about some of these different ones. One of them was, I remember a site over in Mobile, Alabama, and it was a former gas station site. This site had a previous phase one done on it by another company. It had an underground storage tank removal, soil samples taken, these kinds of things on it. They had a letter from the state agency saying no further action required. So by, you know, all appearances, it looked like a good site. And one of my partners back in the early days was out there looking at it, and he happened to have knowledge of that specific area right there about how sandy the soil was and how deep it was to groundwater. And another buyer came in and did not have a lot of risk tolerance and said, man, I really want to know what potential issues I have out here. I don't mind paying for it. So my partner came in and the old former dispenser island went right beneath the dispenser island, put a boring down, and guess what? Down at 40 feet, there were 2 feet of gasoline floating on top of the groundwater, free product there. And what had happened, because of those very sandy conditions there, when some leak had occurred at the dispenser pump many, many years ago, and rather than spreading out horizontally, it went straight down like water through a bucket of marbles and went all the way to the groundwater table. So there was a, even though it had been closed out, there was a big environmental risk on this one that had to be addressed. So that's one. I've got a photo of that one I keep in some of my presentations because it just reminds me of how easy it is to miss something. So that was a good one we found. One that we missed is PPM. If I can fess up, Todd, you may have been involved with this project yourself. It's one in Texas. And it was, we were representing the buyer of a piece of property, and the site was all grown up. It was vacant property, and we didn't find any issues out there. It was bought, and then when the owner was clearing the property, guess what? He found an old oil well on the property, and he wasn't real happy about it. And really, I mean, there wasn't any environmental conditions associated with it, but it's something that we missed because of lack of access to that grown-up area that should have been in a report. You know, you can argue about how much clearing do you do to get in the woods and find things or not. And, but anyway, we had an unhappy client, and Todd, I'll let you finish the story. We didn't want an unhappy client, and we didn't want a lawsuit against us either. So how did we resolve that one? Do you recall?
I do. So, and that can happen because, you know, just like subsurface is really difficult because we can't see under the subsurface, but on the surface we can see, but sometimes things are so grown up and so overgrown, you can't get through the whole project or whole property. How much do we clear out? But in that one, we got with the Texas Railroad Commission and their abandoned site group to help get down there on their radar to make sure that they would get that oil well and its associated components closed out in the correct manner.
Yep, that's right. So I remember that one. One that I see commonly missed out there too, I've been on both sides of the issue on this one, is you get into an old auto repair shop or a machine shop or something that's been there for a long while. They'll typically have floor drains in there, and maybe it's a painting booth or something. And what happens is these floor drains, you see a hole in the ground, and it's a great way to just quickly dispose of oil or parts cleaning solvents, other chemicals, things like that. And so we've had situations to where the facility was built and in operation before city sewer came in, and they had a septic system out there, a tank in the ground with field lines going out behind it. And you had mechanics and workers in there for many, many years have been pouring chemicals down the floor drains that go out into the septic tank and then out into the field lines. And you've had pretty bad contamination problems in soil and groundwater associated with a little 6-inch opening, you know, in the floor of a shop. You know, I've seen that before. And a lot of times these chemicals, they, you know, certain types of chemicals like parts cleaning solvents, chlorinated solvents, they can actually eat through the piping and leak. And I've been in ones where the entire slab had chlorinated solvent impact all beneath it. So it looked pretty benign from the surface, but again, a problem below the ground.
And Mike, one of the best things about the due diligence process is sometimes, well, the main reason why I do it is there are things that were used and maybe they're blighted, beginning to run down and not so attractive. But the due diligence process helps new developers, new energy, come into a site and either determine what's there or maybe it looks really bad, but it isn't. Do you have anything to share along the lines of it looked really bad, but if you really studied it, it turned out there weren't any true environmental impacts?
You know, one that comes to mind on that, Todd, is this was a chemical plant in Texas, and we were representing a local bank who were going to foreclose on this. It had been a startup operation. They had a lot of infrastructure in the ground, piping, process equipment, and before they took it back, they wanted us to go and make sure before they took it back there weren't any environmental issues on it. And so I went out on this one myself, and I got there, and there were over 100 drums of chemicals with no labels on them. Didn't know if it was waste, didn't know if it was virgin chemicals used in the process. All their equipment was filled with different types of chemicals. And they had bought the property for next to nothing. And a little research showed us that it had actually been an industrial landfill that the chemical plant was built on next to a stream. So we knew this was a huge issue with all this. And so we went to work. They really wanted us to go the extra mile. We did some phase two environmental site assessment, installed soil borings and wells, didn't find any impact at all in the industrial landfill. It was remarkable that it was that clean. We went in and characterized all the waste materials in the drums, the process equipment. None of it came back hazardous. In fact, there was a recycler that wanted those chemicals for different reasons in their process. And so we were able to arrange a market value for that stuff for them to come and get it with no cost and all. And so that's one that I just knew was going to be, you know, a really expensive environmental matter for the bank to deal with that they foreclosed on and end up being okay.
Well, and that's why we go through the process, and that's why we got to get boots on the ground and do that. And to our listeners out there, Mike, if you do a phase one, which is the first level of study to determine if there are potential environmental concerns or not, the next step would be a phase two. And as you think through some of these, the one you just gave, from the phase one perspective, a lot of concerns, a lot of red flags potentially on this chemical facility. But once you actually went to the phase two, the actual study process and begin to collect samples, you're able to determine that the risks weren't as threatening as they appeared.
That's right. And just as a matter of distinction on that, you know, the phase one, it's you're not doing any type of really testing. You're not collecting samples of anything. You're just identifying on paper any potential risk. And then the phase two, like you said, is they're actually confirming yes or no. Is there a problem there?
Absolutely. Well, Mike, I think we got a couple more, not surprises, but things of interest to share with our listening audience. As we've been doing this work since 1994, and I don't know what the phase one count would be in the firm, but I know it's thousands through the years. What are some of the more interesting things we've encountered that you may not expect to encounter during the due diligence process?
Well, maybe one of the creepiest one, I was not involved in this one, but one of our guys in our Mobile, Alabama office was, and he was on a site in Florida, and it was, about 100-acre agricultural property. And lo and behold, he's on the back 40 and comes across a dead body on the property. And he was actually training somebody out there. And this young lady, well, let's just say her reaction was pretty negative to that discovery on the property. And so the authorities got called and all. But I think that's the only time I know of when that's been encountered. A kind of a funny one here. We're doing a big brownfield redevelopment project over here in Alabama at a former mill, giant mill, used to employ 2,000 people. It got abandoned. It's caught on fire. It's been kicked around. It's right in the middle of town. And some of the remaining structures out there, there was actually a dog colony. I mean, maybe 30, 40 dogs. And they actually got adopted by the town. And there was a charity group put together to kind of feed these dogs. You couldn't get near them. They wouldn't let you. I mean, they were wild animals. You could not get anywhere near them, but they could be fed and water brought out to them. And so the community kind of took them in prior to the redevelopment of that property. So that was kind of funny. Another one, too, that I found was over here. This was in central Alabama. It's an area where we have a lot of shallow limestone at the surface. And we were doing a big regional groundwater study to figure out where the groundwater was moving, where it was going towards in relation to the municipal water wells, basically making sure there's no impacts coming. And I'll never forget being out there. And one of the things we look for is evidence of sinkholes, where a cave near the surface, the top roof has collapsed, it forms a sinkhole. Well, guess what? Farmers for years in these areas, those are perfect places for them to throw their garbage into, their waste into. They cut limbs down, they throw them into it, and they just kind of disappear down in the sinkhole. And so I was out doing some field work and had a farmer, and he was really going off against the government for lots of different reasons, especially with environmental rules and regulations, saying it's the craziest thing he's ever heard. And I said, well, I understand, sir. I said, I just want to find out if you had any evidence of sinkholes on your property. Yep, there's one back here. He took me out there, and it had dead cattle in it. It had drums of pesticides that he'd thrown in there. And he told me his family had been doing that for generations out there. And so this was a direct conduit into the groundwater system, the municipal well is pulling from about a quarter of a mile away. And so in his mind, you know, all this environmental is crazy, and he was actually a contributor to a potentially bad problem based on what he was throwing down in that sinkhole. So,
yeah, he thought that he had developed his own landfill on his property. Little did he know of the impact he was causing.
That's right. And just one last thing, I remember one day in Mississippi where it was an industrial facility. They made a type of glue that went under rugs to hold rugs down. And the owner was selling it, and he was so proud of everything being so pristine and clean. And I happened to be down the street at the local burger joint getting some lunch, and the guy asked me what I was doing in town. And I told him, and he said, well, you know, my uncle lives across the street from there, and he used to work there. You might want to talk to him. So I went up and talked to Uncle Joe, and he told me exactly where the industry had buried the drums of chemicals for years and years and years when he worked there back in the 60s and 70s on the property. So you think that one was an environmental risk?
Yeah.
So these interviews with some of these old timers, I'm an old timer now, so I can use that word and not be offensive, but they can give you a remarkable amount of information much quicker than you can do doing record searches and those kinds of things.
Well, this will be a tale for another podcast, but it's been said even in the history of our firm that, you know, under certain environmental circumstances, we will buy meals for senior citizen centers. So we'll tell that tale another day.
That's right.
We'll tell that tale another day. Well, Mike, this has been fantastic. I know our audience has enjoyed it. And of course, if you're listening to this and you want to share some of your stories or want to know more about the due diligence process, you can easily reach out to myself or Mike via our website. You can go to ppmco.com, ppmco.com, and you'll see about us and our contact information. You can reach out to us directly. Mike, anything else you'd like to share with our listening audience before we wrap this podcast up?
Just, I guess, just understand there's no substitute for good environmental due diligence. If you're buying a property, have an interest in that. Make sure you have a firm that knows what they're doing. Ask questions, read the report. A lot of times these things end up being what we call file stuffers, where, you know, somebody looks at the last page and that's it. But, you know, be involved with the process and make sure that if things are being done the right way, if you have questions, ask them. And keep the consulting where it needs to be, giving you the services you deserve as a client.
Mike, well said, my friend, and this has been fantastic. Thanks for making time. Again, I know our audience enjoyed it. We look forward to hearing from you and look forward to you listening in and to the rest of our podcast series this year in 2024 as we kick it off. So we'll leave you with this. Thank you for tuning in, and this is PPM Simplifies. Thank you for finding our podcast. For more information, be sure to visit our website at ppmco.com. To stay updated on new episodes, feel free to subscribe to PPM Simplifies on your podcast app of choice. Until next time, this is PPM Simplifies.